Hello, this is Kevin Barrett. You're listening to the dog-faced Hermans doing Volkswagen. You know, my first ever vehicle was a Volkswagen. I used to have a Volkswagen bus. I pulled the engine out of it myself 3 times. But, you know, I may never own another Volkswagen again unless you go to truthjihad.com and give me a one-time donation or sign up to be a subscriber. The Volkswagen that you helped me buy may come in handy someday. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, the Truth Jihadi radio host, pursuing truth to the ends of the earth, all the way to China if necessary. As the Hadith says that we're supposed to pursue learning. I'm interested in rethinking the world that we live in to escape from the matrix of lies, the prison that we've been locked up in at least since September 11, 2001, and maybe since a lot longer ago than that. And today, I'm going to talk with somebody who's just put out a great book. I really enjoyed it. I read it in one swoop on the bus from Chicago to Madison, Wisconsin. 3-hour bus ride. I devoured this book. And I have to say that I'm always pleased to find a good literary treatment of the truthful post-9/11 situation. Such treatments are few and far between, but here's one. It's called Days of Shock, Days of Wonder, The 9/11 Age, The Ways of the Mystics, and One Man's Escape from Babylon in the Belly of a Whale. It's by Rafiq. So, welcome, Rafiq. Should we use your other name, too, or not?
Oh, it doesn't matter to me. You know, when I started using that name, Rafiq, it seemed suitably subversive to take a Muslim name at a time when, a religion was being vilified for 9/11, and there were, of course, no Muslims involved in that attack. I've often joked with people, too, when I stopped living on the road in the belly of the whale after 2 years of travel, I had a very long beard, and people asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, you know, we should be ashamed to show our faces in this day and age. So I had the beard, but eventually I trimmed it back. I didn't want to create any barrier between myself and anyone else, which is what I think religion often does, and that's not something I wanted to do. But yeah, I keep the name Rafiq, so you can call me that.
Okay, well, I like that. You know, I find actually the shorter beard, which, you know, is a little bit less Islamically kosher. You know, if you want to be fully Islamically kosher in your facial appearance, which frankly I don't think is really the issue. It's the soul is the issue. But if you want to do that, you're supposed to grow kind of a long, bushy beard. And I've trimmed mine a little bit, but you know, my wife says that it keeps less distance from her if I grow the longer beard because it's softer. But okay. In any case, yeah, I think we should be afraid to show our faces. I mean, this is just so criminal what's been going on. And your story is interesting in a lot of ways, and one of them is learning how you came to terms with it. You were teaching writing, and this book opens, 9/11 happens, your initial reactions, and then how you kind of gradually developed a deeper perspective on it, both spiritually and in terms of what really happened and what's really going on in the world.
Yeah, it was uncanny. There's a lot of uncanny moments in that book, as you know. Some would call them miraculous. I don't use the word miraculous because that suggests maybe a separation of the divine from the profane, or an intervention of a hand from outside of creation coming in to change things. And I don't think for the miraculous to happen, the universe needs to change its laws or do anything differently than it does normally. It's just all these beautiful synchronicities and coincidences that mark our lives. And in that particular case, it was one of my students in that writing course that winter after 9/11 was the son of Pakistan's ambassador to Canada. Sharp kid, 18 years old, and really steady, a beautiful, calm nature that I admired. And we were walking to the bus stop one night, and he asked me what I thought about bin Laden. And, you know, the idea that bin Laden was the enemy number one had been conveniently planted in my psyche before 9/11 through the embassy bombings in Africa, for which he was indicted in the U.S. courts. He was, of course, not indicted for 9/11 in the U.S. courts because the FBI has said there is no evidence to support that indictment. But because that had been planted in my psyche, I just went more or less along with the idea that, yeah, it was bin Laden. But he started to ask me if I knew about bin Laden's connections to the CIA. And of course, at that time, my mind had to really do a shift, a paradigm, a flip. What are you asking me to think about or to entertain here? I wasn't even really prepared to consider the possibility that 9/11 had been aided by perhaps elements within the U.S. government and certainly covered up after the fact. But, you know, in the end, as you know, Kevin, what he said was already in the public domain. Everything about bin Laden's work with the CIA from the 1980s on was already in the public domain, as was his meeting with CIA operatives at a hospital in Dubai in August, a month prior to 9/11, when they could have, of course, arrested him for the embassy bombings, but that would have been inconvenient when they needed him as a patsy for the upcoming 9/11 attack.
Well, it's interesting. Your Pakistani student said, as you report in the book, that everybody in Pakistan knows bin Laden works for the CIA. And you might think that's an exaggeration until you look at the polling data from World Public Opinion, which found that only 3% of Pakistanis believe the official story of 9/11. 97% don't. So I think that your student was basically right.
Yeah, and I had a friend come back from traveling in Egypt recently, and he says everybody, every taxi driver, everybody in the restaurants will tell you that bin Laden, of course, was a CIA operative, and that the U.S. is working with ISIS presently, and you know, is it ISIS? Everybody over there regards ISIS as a tool of the CIA and the United States, and yeah, it's really this news blackout on our side of the planet that is so peculiar.
Well, it is. Yeah, it's strange that Pakistanis would be so much better informed than Americans. On the other hand, I suppose since Al Qaeda was formed and grew up over in that part of the world, it and of course bin Laden was in a Pakistani military hospital on 9/11 itself, and then he repeatedly denied and deplored 9/11, said he had nothing to do with it. It was done by a certain group of Americans with their own agenda, and hinted that that was the Zionists. And of course that never got reported here beyond very, you know, back page little tiny news stories. But yeah, I guess the Pakistanis picked up on it.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Rebecca Roth, now we are able to add more evidence to the Mossad angle of the 9/11 story. But
can you elaborate on that? Because I interviewed Rebecca quite a while back, and now the only time I see her name is with various people, including my former False Flag Radio co-host Jim Fetzer, who is attacking her as some kind of a phony. So I haven't really kept up with Rebecca's more recent research.
Yeah, I saw what looked like a credible radio interview with her, and there was some photographic evidence of the art students, the Israeli art students, who had been allowed to do a project in one of the towers where they removed a window. And
wait a minute, I broke that story.
Oh, you broke that story?
I broke that story years ago. Yeah. I had Jonathan, Jonathan, what's his name, from Denver on the show. And he actually found those photos and stuff. So I published all that years ago.
Okay, so that's brilliant footage, right? Because you've got all those boxes with the fuses that would have been needed for some kind of demolition explosives. Yeah. So that stuff is there. And then she reported, which I haven't heard before, was the eyewitness account of a military-looking airplane about the size of a passenger airliner on the flight trajectory toward New York at the time, you know, at the appropriate time that would have fit for the second plane to have hit.
Now, I need to look into that because I have her first book, but I think there's a new book out I haven't looked at yet.
Yeah, and her, you know, of course, we know that the Canadian researchers have made it clear that those planes that supposedly hit the towers were never decommissioned and continued to fly, you know, I think until 2008 or something like that. So she makes it very clear in her latest work that I've seen, Rebecca Roth, that those airline liners were diverted to a hangar, and that those supposed phone calls from the airplanes were made in rooms upstairs inside the hangar, that the stewardesses were making comments that contradicted each other because they weren't actually sitting beside each other. Right. and other things like that. So
yeah, that's a plausible scenario. I would go along with that. I do have friends, people that I respect, like Robin Horton, former air traffic controller out in Seattle. Shout out to Robin, who listens to all these shows, that are not convinced. You know, he thinks it was the original Boeings that went into these targets. I'm not so sure myself, but I do agree with Rebecca that the phony cell phone calls probably were made from the ground.
Right, yeah. And there was something interesting she indicated, too. You know, there's all this talk about, well, if it was a drone that hit the tower, why did it look on our TV screens like it was, an actual passenger airliner? Never mind the photographs that show that there was something attached to the bottom that may have caused the tower to explode before the plane even hit it. She reveals that there is a company with ties to a number of suspect individuals that does this kind of real-time editing. You know, in a hockey game, they can put a color on the hockey puck so you know where it is on the ice.
Right, or in football games, the first down marker is a magical stripe that gets painted on your screen.
Right, and of course, the people at the field don't see that, and the people at the hockey game don't see that, but that's real-time editing because there's a delay, there's a lag, 4 to 7 seconds or whatever it happens to be. So with this real-time editing, she argues that this company could have simply made the on-screen image of that airplane look like a passenger airliner with real-time editing. And it's entirely plausibly stated. Not to get off track here, Kevin, but this stuff is all circumstantial, and in the end, it's for a jury to pick through this stuff and decide what seems credible. There's certainly enough forensic evidence to justify, the fact that we want to call for this kind of an investigation.
Absolutely. And so you've been figuring this out kind of gradually, and of course, all of us have our stories. If I were a folklorist working on the folklore of the 9/11 truth community, the first thing I would ask, the same way an anthropologist, the first thing they would ask would be, what are your kinship terms? Well, as a 9/11 truth folklorist, I would ask, how did you figure this out? And so we all have our stories, and you're a good writer and a good storyteller, and so you've offered a compelling narrative of your own awakening here. So you started coming around after you heard from your Pakistani student that the CIA owned bin Laden, and kind of took it from there.
Yeah, I was really focused on the clash between Islam and Christianity. And so I was more interested in understanding the history of those religions. And in the end, I concluded that they, as monotheistic faiths and sister faiths, they were pretty much indistinguishable. And of course, that neither was prone to breeding killers. So that was my first focus, and part of that became my own personal spiritual quest when I went to India and lived with the Sufis. I was interested in looking or experiencing a religion that didn't locate the divine outside of the individual, which was sort of to counter the idea of the divine post 9/11, which was this God or Allah that could take sides in the war on terror. And I think our idea about the divine is extremely important. It shapes many aspects of our societies. I agree with indigenous scholar and 9/11 activist Four Arrows that there are
shout
really
out to Four Arrows. He's a friend and frequent guest.
See, yeah. There are really only two worldviews. One is essentially the dominant worldview that we have, which is Western and divisive. And the other is the holistic indigenous worldview. And so within religion, I started to recognize that the monotheistic faiths are, although they all have holistic ideas inside of them, such as the idea of the Holy Spirit in Christianity, which locates the divine inside of you, and many sayings of the prophet Muhammad that suggest that the divine is very close at hand. These faiths in locating the divine largely outside of the self, which means that you need to access them through a mediator such as the scriptures or a savior or a prophet, they are ultimately divisive worldviews. Whereas the indigenous, being non-hierarchical and not making a separation between the sacred and the profane, sees all of creation as inspirited, infused with spirit and divinity and sacredness. And so that was part of my quest. But what happened when I came back from India is I was in a state of reverse culture shock. I was hypersensitive to the ethos of the West and what is actually driving our culture. And in the end, and as I describe it in the book, it's a cult of money and death. Mm. Money and death.
Right.
And that's the point when I stopped denying the hints that had been coming to me that there was something to look at related to 9/11. And one of those hints was just a simple, I think, couldn't have been more than 5-minute video that my younger brother had sent me that someone had sent him on the internet. And it covered the basic forensics, you know, the hot spots at ground zero, the melting temperature of steel, you know, just the basic forensics that make it clear that the towers could not have collapsed the way we were told. And that was 2005, and I had to make a choice then whether to engage or not, and I didn't engage because I wasn't ready. I knew that if I really accepted what I was hearing, I would need to react. And I wasn't ready to react. But when I came back from India, I was ready. It was 2007 by that time. So I went to ground zero for the anniversary of that year, and I just talked to the truth activists. I wanted to see if they were sane people without an agenda. And they were. They were from many, many walks of life. And I, in fact, talked to Robin Horden at ground zero. He's the one who told me that Rumsfeld had changed the order of command so that any scrambling of jets, fighter jets to intercept airliners, had to go through him, had to go through the Pentagon on 9/11.
Right. So you know, getting back to this thought about the divine, I think it's very interesting, and I can see how you sort of gravitated towards a more mystical interpretation of Islam, since Islam has as the sort of core doctrine this notion of tawhid or divine unity, you know, absolute divine unity. And you were kind of seeing this unity that, you know, we all share kind of the same thing, that there is this all-pervading unity, and Christians and Muslims are basically the same, and so on. But as far as whether the divine is seen as inside or outside, I think usually the best answer from Islam and maybe from metaphysics in general is none of the above, or you know, all of the above. That is, that, you know, if you go too far in either direction, if you say that God is just outside of us, you know, obviously you can have this totally divided worldview that's been, as Four Arrows explains, you know, such a part of the West's war on the earth. But if you were to locate God inside yourself in the wrong way, such as, you know, my ego is God, or my tribal ego, which is, in a sense, I think, the mistake that a lot of Judaism makes, by believing in the chosen people, God's chosen people, which is basically what they worship, and it's become idolatrous, and that's bad too. So, you know, the real situation is beyond what language can describe, and I think that and that's of course what the mystics from all the traditions understand.
You're absolutely right, because otherwise you have delusions of grandeur, people killing in the name of God, even in contradiction of what they're claiming to believe. But I think I addressed this in the book in terms of Carl Jung's idea of the unification of our consciousness. And he simplifies Freud's model, but Jung suggests that essentially there is the left and right brain, or the Eastern mind and Western mind, the intuitive mind and the rational mind. And I would say that in a sense, if we just call these the ego mind and the divine mind, or the ego mind and the timeless mind, then we recognize that within each individual we have the potential for either to express more than the other, and also the potential to achieve ultimately a balance between those two things, which Jung called unifying your consciousness. Mm-hmm. I kind of like Freud's idea a little bit, in the sense that I perceive that there is a third part. Of course, Freud called what Jung calls the ego, Freud called it the id. And then the third part is the mediator, which he called the ego. So this mediator, I just call it the self. And the self is a mixture. It's a combination of your divine and ego selves.
That sounds like a pretty good model. I'll grant you all of that. So you spent time with Sufis in India, and your description of the Sufis in India was kind of interesting, because I'm more cognizant of Sufis from the Moroccan traditions
and or Turkey.
You those Indian Sufis, they sound like a bunch of total hippies, you know, in Morocco.
They're called the wild Sufis of India.
The Sufis I hung out with in Morocco can get really ecstatic as they chant, you know, Quranic formulas, but anyway, I didn't smell any hashish during the dhikr sessions over there. But in India, it sounds like you did.
Yes. Well, the good friend that I made in India, Peter, who introduced me to the Baba that I ended up living with for 3 months, he had actually just come from living with the Sufis in Turkey. And there, they all had to be underground. It was highly illegal. And it was a very strict experience, he said. It was very, very disciplined and harsh. And now he was with the wild Sufis of India. And of course, they're very much into using zikr, which is a Persian word that means remembrance. And it's chanting to remember the inner divine. And they use zikr, which is, even though they're Urdu and Hindu speakers, or Hindi speakers rather, they're all using Arabic in their religious ceremony, which was, I just found it the most poetic and beautiful thing to trance out to. But I had some fascinating experiences, Kevin. We were in Jaipur, and we went into a beautiful courtyard. There was a mosque in the middle, and there was an overhang where we could go underneath on a dirt area and stay out of the sun. And, you know, the Sufis just put some blankets on the ground, and we sleep wherever we can. Their motto, or, well, not their motto, but their ethos is, you know, poverty and charity. Well, the Baba had left. He'd gone off to visit people in the neighborhood and the community, which he does, which is so much like the indigenous shamans. You know, they don't separate themselves from the community. They're always going door to door, as it were. Anyway, one of the guys came out of the mosque. Now, he was a proper Muslim. And he scolded me. He wanted to know what I was doing hanging around with these Sufis. And he said, if I wanted to be a good Muslim, there were five things that I needed to do. And of course, you know what they are. And he ended with the Mecca to the Hajj after he'd listed the five things. And I looked at the scorn in his eyes, and I looked at the love in the eyes of the Sufis that I was living with. And there was no question in my mind that I was going to continue to stay with the Sufis. He kicked us all out. We had to sleep in the field across the road, and it started raining that night, so we had to get up at 2 in the morning and take rickshaws all the way back to New Delhi in the middle of the night. And that was his act of charity.
Right. Well, you know, there's, I think, a role in this world for different kinds of people. But it's been a tragedy, in my opinion, that Sufism has been sort of split off from Islam in the minds of people like this guy that you're referring to, the strict Orthodox Muslim who looks down his nose at those crazy wild Sufis. Because I think, you know, Sufism is very much an integral dimension of Islam. There's a famous hadith about this, it's beautification, that, you know, in Islam there's sort of like three things. There's just plain old, you know, surrender, submission, and then there's the faith, which is a deeper kind of surrender, submission, and then finally there's beautification. And this beautification is the absolute perfection of the heart and of one's world, and that's the dimension that the Sufis focus on. But regular Islam isn't fully completed without that. So, like, this guy that you met really needed that dimension to perfect his Islam. He didn't have to go out and sleep in the rough. He didn't have to smoke dope, but no. He still was missing something.
See, yeah, very much so.
Yeah. So anyway, this story was very refreshing for me. I could relate to this. You know, it was almost like, in ways, you know, you and I led slightly parallel lives. You know, I hung out with Sufis in Morocco before 9/11. You hung out with Sufis in India after 9/11. You lived in a Volkswagen bus after 9/11, and I lived in a Volkswagen bus before 9/11, and okay. So on and so forth. So catching up here, so you're back from India, and you kind of, you know, look at the video and go, oh man, 9/11 is even worse than I realized. And then what?
Yeah, I came back from New York from that anniversary in 2007, and I went through that experience that a lot of us have gone through. Some refer to it as going down the rabbit hole. Some people refer to it as taking, I don't know which pill it is in the matrix, the blue or the red one. But the point
it's,
is...
It's the red pill.
Yeah, the red
pill. Don't take the blue pill.
No. So I watched every documentary that the activists had given me at Ground Zero, and I read a lot of the literature. And in the end, it's so commonsensical that you can't ignore it. And that leads you into looking at the bigger picture. So you start looking at the Federal Reserve and the CIA and the history with Kennedy and Peter Dale Scott calls, you know, deep politics, or other people refer to it as the shadow government. And I went all the way to the end of that, waking up to the world that we're living in. And it was disillusioning. It was very discouraging. I ask the question in the book, you know, when you come face to face with the understanding that force in your culture, weaponry, guns, the power to murder the citizens, all of this force is concentrated in the hands of the government. They are regarded by people psychologically as, you know, father figures, the figurehead of the nation. One of the men I interviewed at Ground Zero, he told me that his grandmother said that, you know, if George Bush was behind 9/11, she would have to leave the country. And she was too old to do that, so she couldn't accept it. And I think that says a lot about the psychological state many people are in when they're forced to look at a father figure or a hero figure or even just the whole idea of the nation and nationalism as being a scam. George Bush's interests were never nationalistic. They're internationalistic and they're part of a much larger picture. So anyway, I came to terms with that, and I wrote a play exploring responding to this reality with violence. It was a cautionary play.
And we talked about that on the radio a while back.
Yes, you had me on the show, and we talked about that play. It was called Revolution in the Head. You know, the characters, the activists in it, they kidnap Philip Zelikow, the head of the 9/11 Commission, who has a very strange educational pedigree. He's up there now with George Lucas as one of the two great myth makers of our times.
Right, yeah, only Lucas didn't have to kill thousands of people to do his special effects.
Right, and then lie about it afterwards. Right. So I wrote that play, but ultimately I wanted to test out our democracy and see if it was the answer, not resorting to violence, not that violence could work anyway. And particularly not that I want to become that which I'm confronting. I have no desire to become the evil that I want to confront. And so,
I remember when I interviewed you, I got some of the same responses that you got from people, you know, like, because I had a hard time sort of restraining myself from just kind of going, wow, kidnapping Zelikow, what a great idea. And then, like, wait a minute, I better not say that. And then, of course, yeah, the nonviolence people, like my good friend Robin that we already mentioned, would come down on me, you know, say, don't call for violence. You know, well, okay. No. But I don't know. I mean, I'm not that kind of millenarian, absolute nonviolence person. You know, I think if you're a Christian, that might make sense, the turn the other cheek model. But in Islam, as I understand it, you know, they were going to sacrifice Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him. They had guys from each tribe were going to plunge a separate knife into him. And he snuck out of town before they could get him. And God gave him permission to fight back. And so Islam does represent the good people establishing truth and justice. And that means they sometimes do have to use force against the bad people. Now, it's too easy to start thinking, oh, I'm always the good guy, and start using force too quickly. But in reality, we need that discernment to see, you know, what is the truth, what is justice, and then we need to put ourselves at risk and use some level of force, preferably the minimum, to establish truth and justice.
Yeah, I think it's naive to believe that we can change the world we live in, when so much force is being used against us. And as many great thinkers have said, evil will triumph if good people do nothing. I think, though, that the violence needs to come from the violent people. I think that the military needs to turn on its government and say, you've lied to us, you've misused us, you've used us in illegal wars, you've made us complicit in horrific crimes, and we're taking you out of power. That's where I see how the guns could be used in resolving this situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. A combination of people power and then the military and police siding with the people. Kind of like in the ending of V for Vendetta.
Yeah. That's where I sit. So in the end, I did test our democracy. I had a petition that was, you know, read into Parliament by the Canadian, by one of the MPs into the Canadian Parliament. And it was scheduled to be read in the House for debate. That was part of that march on Ottawa in 2008, where all of the 9/11 truth chapters in Canada coordinated their efforts. And we congregated in Montreal. We did a caravan to Ottawa, and then we were there on the hill for the anniversary to support the petition. But Stephen Harper had dissolved Parliament and called a new election. So that petition died an untimely death. And there's been other efforts to get petitions in front of the House. In the end, Kevin, I came to the realization that changing the system was going to exhaust me. Trying to change the system from within was going to exhaust me. There was a certain degree to which I wanted to resume my, you know, the Sufi path of the heart and my spiritual journey. And so I ended up going in search of alternatives, really, to the system. I think that a lot of the people I met in my 9/11 truth activism, they would ask me, okay, so now we know what happened, what can I do? And there was no master plan for our revolution. And I often didn't have an answer. I ended up saying to them, well, you know, a revolutionary is someone who uses whatever they do to be who they truly are. So whether you're a school teacher, a taxi driver, or whoever you happen to be, you can walk with integrity and speak the truth when opportunities present themselves. But for me, in the end, that wasn't enough. I needed to go and find another way to be, another way to live in the world, which is why I left.
And so then you went nomad. And this is something that's, you know, fascinated me for a long time. I actually lived partially nomadically in vehicles, including both an old Volkswagen, a 1970 Volkswagen bus, a 1955 half-size Chevy school bus, and then a 1964 Dodge Travco motorhome. So up until I got married and came to Islam at age 35, I spent most of my adult life living in these vehicles. And so it does give you a different perspective, doesn't it?
It does. There's probably two or three things that I would point out. One is that it requires you to be fearless. The second is that it requires you to be an outlaw. And the third is that it puts you into the slipstream of life, into the current of life, where happy accidents occur, where synchronicities and coincidences occur in abundance, in ways that they never seem to do in the static routine of a life that I was living in the city, in Montreal.
Yeah, you mentioned cases where, you know, you bog down in the sand in Baja at the beach and the tide's coming in and you just happen to, you know, luck out into finding the right guy to help pull you out, things like that. Yeah, that's, I remember, actually fondly remember being, you know, constantly facing that sort of thing when I was a nomad.
Yeah, and it never ceases to amaze you. Eventually you reach a point, though, where you're just quietly grateful. Instead of jumping up and down, you start to, oh yeah, this is how the universe works.
Right.
You know, you're always already okay.
Yeah.
Even when you don't think you're okay, you're more than okay. And you know, you might remember in my trip across Canada, there were setbacks. I arrived in BC and realized I hadn't renewed my passport and I was stuck there for a couple of months. And so many fascinating things happened during those 2 months. I ended up at a Buddhist retreat center. I went to that Halloween party where there was just, you know, fantastic, interesting things going on. Anyway, you get the point.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And these kinds of, like, little, you know, synchronicities is what Jung called them, you know, these kind of amazingly meaningful kind of coincidences that crop up, I think are in one form of what in Islam we talk about as the ayatullah or signs of God. That is, because, you know, if God is this ultimate unity, you know, both within us and without us.
And in nature, Kevin.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so, the four arrows always gets on me to emphasize that, because we forget that. And in the end, it was nature that saved me.
Yeah, you know, and nature is, it's full of its own meaning and its own life and its own consciousness. And so we really should be reading the world as consciousness and meaning, and not as like dull brute, you know, space, time, and matter. And I think Four Arrows does understand that very deeply.
Thank you. Yeah, he does. So I interrupted you. What did you?
No, I think I was just going to make some comment about the kind of Tawheed or unity having something to do with these, you know, synchronicities, or these little moments of signs of God or moments of coincidence with incredible layers upon layers of meaning, that the it's ultimately all one, and these moments that telescope many different kinds of meaning, many things together, all in sort of one moment, are moments of kind of oneness or bringing together of everything. At least that's been my experience.
Absolutely, and that in the end becomes my definition for God. God is that phenomenon of unity within apparent division or individuality. It's the phenomena of interconnection across space and time, you know, spooky action at a distance, Einstein called it. And in my first book, it was a book of philosophy called The End of Religion, I look at this idea of the divine. And it just seems to me that every culture, every people has talked about the divine, because they were all pointing at some phenomena that was actually present, something that was actually there and being experienced. You know, we hear the argument, and I made it as a university student, I made the argument as an atheist that, oh yeah, people just, you know, they believe in God because they're afraid of death and they want something to help them, you know, deal with that reality. But I think a more sophisticated response now is to say, no, we've been pointing at something in our actual experience and calling it God. And I've reached the point through my experience, and I really do believe that, you know, I've tried to base my views on experience and not on random beliefs. In my experience, God is this phenomenon of interconnection, despite our apparent individuality.
And I see these moments as signs of God. That is, they're pointing at God, but what God is not something that you can ever really pin down. So you're always getting there, but you're never really there. I mean, maybe somebody is.
No, and I don't think that God can even step outside of God and look at itself. The universe is a closed system. The universe is God. It's a single life force or a single energy. And in order for it to experience itself, to know itself, it needed to divide itself from the one into the many so that it could look into its own eyes.
Like the hidden treasure hadith.
That it could love.
yeah. Where there's that hadith that says... where God is speaking, it's a hadith Qudsi, meaning a hadith that Prophet Muhammad related, but it was words of God, but it wasn't Quran, and it goes that God says, I was a hidden treasure, and I wanted to be known, and so I created the universe so that I could be known.
Yes, and so that I could know myself.
And so I could know myself, right. Yeah, yeah. I think that there are some nuances of translation of that get endlessly rehashed. And then there are even questions of authenticity. So it's a long story if you get into the scholarly angle. But anyway, I love that hadith.
Yeah, and on the temple at Delphi, apparently there's an inscription that says, "Know thyself, and you will know the universe and all the gods." And so self, universe, and God are synonymous in that configuration.
And the way you took off in search of self, universe, and God... after being disillusioned by this realization of how horrible the society around you was, or how bad things had gotten, and took off traveling with a kind of a spiritual search, as well as a search for sort of little moments of awakening and signs of life in this kind of dead, stultified culture around you in North America. That reminded me a little bit when I was reading this of Jack Kerouac, who was an influence on me when I was in high school. I remember in the 1950s hearing, or rather, I don't remember the 50s, but in the 50s, the USA was kind of smug and satisfied after World War II and settling down to have kids, and people were pretty buttoned up. And at least that's the stereotype, and there's some truth to that. Kerouac was one of the catalysts who took off and traveled and became a nomad in search of something a little deeper than what he was getting or wasn't getting from the mainstream culture. And your story reminds me a little bit of that, only the culture that you're facing is, I guess it is sort of horrific in a similar way to what Kerouac was facing. He was facing this new culture of the atomic bomb that could destroy the planet at a moment's notice. And you're facing the reality of this deep state that's done the 9/11 human sacrifice and brainwashed the whole populace into a state of complete evil idiocy. I was like feeling these sort of echoes of the experience that I had reading Kerouac when I was young, as I read your book.
I I mean, the comparison is obvious when anybody ever, you know, does a road book.
Well, yeah, especially in search of spirituality and surrounded by a you know, bad mainstream culture.
Yeah. It's been years since I read On the Road. I'm trying to remember. I think that Kerouac's ultimate realization was that the American dream was hollow.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't remember now if he finds redemption or not.
You know, in the book, I think he gets some, you know, some glimmers of redemption. In his life, unfortunately, though, he turned to alcohol and it killed him.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, my attitude toward alcohol was... Two homeless Inuit men who I dedicate chapter 3 of my book to. I made a documentary film about two homeless Inuit men I met in Montreal. And I, you know, they were chronic alcoholics, both of them. And I always encouraged them not to drink and to use marijuana instead. It's, you know, at the very least, it's got a few medicinal properties and it's not poison.
So. Right. And here's another place where the Islamic culture seems a little saner than the Western culture.
I do agree.
In Islamic culture, you know, drinking alcohol is a much bigger no-no than smoking marijuana. And frankly, in terms of the deleterious effects of both substances, I think they're onto something.
Yeah, I just don't like the hypocrisy around, you know, our attitude toward alcohol versus marijuana in our culture. But to get back to Kerouac, the way I structured my book was not necessarily... I mean, it's a linear narrative. It passes through time, covers a 13-year period. But in terms of themes, it goes in a spiral. It cycles around on itself. The first 10 chapters are repeated by the second 10 chapters. So it's a journey to the center of the heart, and then it's another journey back to the heart again. And I did that because I don't believe there's any arriving in our lives. And I don't believe in the Western idea that our journeys are linear from point A to point B. I believe that we get frustrated with ourselves because we expect our journeys to be linear. And we arrive back at the same issues or the same themes, and we beat ourselves up and say, how come I didn't resolve this yet? But if we recognize the spiral as getting tighter as we go around each time, we spend less time on each issue and we make progress and carry that forward to the next time until finally we reach the point. So all that to say that, you know, maybe Kerouac didn't find redemption, but I don't claim to have found redemption either. I know that I'm still back again now into another cycle of that path of getting back to the heart. And that's part of staying in the world. That's part of being a human being, I think.
You found a fair number of people along the way who were partly awake, you know, not the sheeple zombies of Walmart or whatever. That seemed to be part of the book too, is and comparable to Kerouac, is sort of searching for what is looking like almost sort of a new version of the counterculture.
Yeah, and something more authentic. And it's amazing now, the town I live in is called Sayulita. It's a little fishing village north of Puerto Vallarta on the west coast of Mexico. But it has a great surf break, so it's become a tourist town. And so we get people all the time from, you know, coming down from the States on holidays, and they're affected very deeply by the energy here. It's a bit of a magical place. In fact, it's been dubbed the Magic City officially now. And they always ask me, how can I stay here? Now that I've seen the alternative, what can I do to be here? And that was really what my journey was about. It was about finding the alternative and then modeling it so that when people do wake up and do want to look at a way that's maybe more earthbound or, you know, just simply more conscious, that they'll be able to do it and imagine it. So I'm constantly now in a situation where I'm allowed to interact with those people from this side of the fence, as it were.
And that's a kind of inspiring message. It's one part of the kind of answer that we can try to offer these people who say, oh, you've just blown up my world. You showed me that 9/11 was an inside job. I've lost faith in all these things I was trained to respect and worship from grade school on. You know, and so what do you want me to do about this? You know, I hear this all the time. Okay, you proved that Charlie Hebdo was yet another 9/11 style inside job. What are we supposed to do about this? And your book sort of, you know, offers a kind of a hint that, you know, maybe awakening is, you know, working on yourself, you know, changing the world by first changing yourself is a big part of it.
It is a big part, and but I think along with that is a very political message in the book. I suggest in the last chapter, where I sort of review our revolutionary options, that ultimately the system needs to be starved. It needs to have our creative energies, our heart energies, withdrawn from it. And those energies need to be channeled elsewhere. One of those things for me would be, if I were to really be able to walk my talk, would be to stop paying my taxes. I don't think that the taxes are needed. They weren't needed under other structures, other ways of you know, running our societies prior to the world wars, and they're not needed now. And this is not to say that, as I say in my book, that you know, there shouldn't be a tax base to fund all kinds of things in society. You know, such as in Canada, we have a very solid healthcare and welfare situation. It's not about not funding those things. It's about using our corporations as the engines for our societies to fund those things, and to stop taxing us for our labor, because we are free human beings. If we're free human beings, then we own our labor and you can't tax us for it. So I think that, you know, I would ultimately like to stop paying my taxes. I'd like to starve that system of my creative energies and my money. And I don't think it's worth doing at this point, because one, I'm a small, you know, insignificant, they probably wouldn't even notice or pay any attention, but there need to be enough of us to do it to make a difference.
Right. Well, I actually did stop paying taxes, or I stopped filing for several years after 9/11. I was so, you know, unhappy with the government. And then finally my wife convinced me to start again, because we actually were getting money back, refunds. Okay. And I was, and she said, "Why are you punishing yourself?" I said, "I don't want their filthy money." She said, "Well, I do." So we were kind of just scraping by.
Well, it raises an interesting issue, though, doesn't it? I mean, we're tied into the system, and we always have to, if we want to live moral lives, if these are things that we're concerned about, then we have to be making these choices and asking these questions.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, my grandfather, he was imprisoned in Winnipeg during the First World War because he was a conscientious objector. He would not kill. And he was young. He was 18, 19 years old and in health, and so they wanted to send him to the front lines. He said, "I'll carry stretchers, I'll cook food, I'll help the medics, I'll do whatever you want, but I won't kill anybody." So they put him in prison, and the prison guards broke his nose, they broke his toes. And, you know, he was a traitor as far as they were concerned. And wow, that kind of courage to stand up to the system is really inspiring to me. You know, I had a lot of trouble finding a publisher for this book, because the publishers want to write about politics or about spirituality, but they don't want to mix the two. But my heroes, you know, like a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or even a Jesus, if you understand him as the revolutionary figure that he was, they did not split their spirituality off from their politics.
And Prophet Muhammad above all.
Yes, clearly, yeah. So that's also been a big part of my journey. So when I talk about getting out of Babylon and leaving the system behind, I'm also conscious that our grandparents and parents invested years of their lives into creating a system. We're very fortunate. We have very few material wants in the West. And I intend to take the best from that system and to use it to create whatever world I can.
Interesting. Beautiful stuff. So your new area in Mexico, that's actually the same part of Mexico where Four Arrows lives, right?
Yeah, he's about 4 hours south of me down the coast on the other side of Vallarta.
Okay. Yeah, I understand he does a fair bit of surfing or paddleboarding or something.
He got me into stand-up paddleboarding, and now I am a stand-up paddleboard surfer, to my amazement.
So you can actually ride the surf on a stand-up paddleboard?
Yes, I have an 8.5-foot board. It's got a nice little pad on the back to ramp up like you're on a skateboard, and then you ride up to the top of the break and down into the wave. You can drop in 2 to 3 times on one wave.
That sounds like fun. You know, he was always trying to talk me into coming down and visiting him, and it was always pretty tempting. You know, maybe I'll have to take him up on that sometime.
Kevin, the three of us would have a wonderful time on his property. I was there house-sitting this summer, pretty much where the hurricane ended up hitting in the fall. And there's islands off the coast. You go paddleboard around the islands. Really, we'd have an amazing time.
Well, that's going to be on my to-do list here for sure.
Okay, just count me in.
Yeah, Four Arrows, he's such a great guy. And reading your book did kind of remind me that the people that I really feel the most affinity for in the 9/11 truth movement are the people who have combined a kind of spiritual dimension to the activism. And Four Arrows is very much at the forefront of that. You also mentioned encountering Sander Hicks.
Yeah, it was uncanny. I encountered Four Arrows on my journey on the road. Sander Hicks called me out of the blue to help him promote his 9/11 truth memoir. Daniel Pinchbeck.
Yeah. Now, how far along with 9/11 truth is he? I had him on the show years ago, and I think he was kind of half hip to it, but he hadn't really taken the full dive, as I recall.
Yeah, I didn't broach the subject with him. We were really focused on the indigenous stuff while he was here. So I don't really know.
Interesting. Yeah. So you met all these, you know, just the right people. Sort of like, you know, Kerouac ran into Neil Cassidy or whatever, Ginsberg and Burroughs and those guys.
Yeah, and I tell you, when I met Four Arrows, he's truly the first Renaissance man I've ever encountered in my life. He's written about 20 books in 10 different fields. He's truly a mentor. Anyway, the door opens, and there he is, bare-chested as we usually are in Mexico. He's got this bones hanging from a mandala, you know, around his on his chest. But he's got this owl on his arm. Wow. This owl is staring into my eyes. Like, it was really, you know.
Sounds like him.
Well, yeah, people bring him animals to tend to, and he's an empath with animals. He used to, you know, he was world-renowned for training wild Mustangs. He was a horse whisperer, as they say. But Four Arrows will tell you whispering has nothing to do with it. It's telepathic communication. Anyway, he believes that when you have close encounters with animals, they mean something. And now in the internet age, we can just go to Google and you know, search for that animal and find out what the significance of it is. Of course, I didn't have to Google what the significance of the owl was. And to have that encounter with this wise man with this owl on his arm. And the owl was only there a few days. It just happened to be at that moment when he opened the door. And there, I'll never forget meeting him. And he's become a very, very good friend and a good influence.
And for listeners who aren't aware of the amazing work of Four Arrows, you can feed his name into a search engine. And, you know, he's co-author with Jim Fetzer of the book American Assassination, The Strange Death of Paul Wellstone. Which is a very important book. He's also a pioneer in the field that I am now also involved in, which is somebody who gets driven out of the academy for talking about 9/11 truth. You know, he did that before I did. And they persecuted him and harassed him, and he finally said goodbye and just left.
You know what I like about his 9/11 activism is that he's had a lot of conversations with other academics and on the left. I won't name any of them. And they all tell him that they don't want to come out in support of 9/11 truth because they don't want to jeopardize all the good work they're doing in other fields, from environmental activism to whatever it is. And his response is, hasn't hurt my work. He's still invited all over the world as an indigenous scholar to talk about his work. It hasn't hurt his work to come out and publish about 9/11. So I'm not sure. He's also the most fearless person I've ever known, so maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, well, he's just totally authentic, and so he's not going to be bending anything he says out of fear. Another really important thing that he's done was he passed to the world this news that a close friend of his, who's a staffer for Senator Barbara Boxer, heard, you know, was there when Boxer told this guy, this friend of his, tell your friend Four Arrows that he doesn't know how right he is about Wellstone. You know, the senator, senator's murder was a message to us all. And then Boxer went on to tell Four Arrows' friend, I will deny having said this if you ever quote me.
Mm-hmm. I heard him on your show. He revealed that on your show.
Yeah, he did. And that was interesting because I also got Boxer to say things that normally she may not have said about how basically she admitted that the counter narrative of 9/11 isn't what the 9/11 Commission said, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. He's an amazing guy. He's really just totally inimitable.
See, I think his most significant contribution in terms of my book is what he taught me about a phenomenon that he calls concentration activated transformation. which is the indigenous understand that when you're in a heightened state of concentration, you're susceptible to transformation of your thinking and of your being. And they would use this very deliberately, but it can also be triggered spontaneously. And this happens most frequently when we are scared. When you're in a heightened state of fear, you're susceptible to hypnosis. And reading his book called Primal Awareness, this became abundantly clear to me that that's what happened to us on 9/11. The second part of his theory of concentration-activated concentration, that's CAT. The second part is FAWN, which is fear, authority, words, and nature. And fear, as I've just explained, and then authority is whatever you turn to in your moment of fear as the root of your authority. The indigenous would say you should turn to your own experience, your own intuition, and ultimately nature should be the ground of your authority. On 9/11, we turned to the father figure of George Bush, and many of us were hypnotized by the lies that he was telling us. So, I had left the West looking for immersion in the indigenous to get away from 9/11 and Four Arrows in the inimitable way that indigenous can do again and again, surprised me and brought me all the way back to 9/11 and the hypnotic effect of that event.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to bring Four Arrows back on the show. It's always been a bit of an issue to get him from his village where he hangs out. I don't know whether his internet is better now than it used to be.
Yes, it is better. I wouldn't have gone to house sit this summer. How sad if it wasn't. And yeah, they do have internet out there now.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. Well, we're going to bring back Four Arrows on Truth Jihad Radio. And one of these days, inshallah, I do hope to visit you and Four Arrows at that magic village in Mexico. Until then, this is Truth Jihad Radio. And thank you so much, Rafiq. It's been a great, great interview. And I do love your book. And once again, how can people find this book, Days of Shock, Days of Wonder?
Yeah, it's going to be available on all the usual point of sale websites, Amazon, and
otherwise. And when will it be available?
I think January 28th right now is the release date.
Cool. Days of Shock, Days of Wonder, The 9/11 Age, The Ways of the Mystics, and One Man's Escape from Babylon in the Belly of a Whale. It's a whale of a good book. Well, thank you so much, Rafiq. I appreciate it and look forward to touching bases down the line.
You are welcome. It's been a huge pleasure.
Likewise.
Para Beto, para Dina, chega a bênção de Claudina. Anda minha mãe Mufina, que saudade das meninas. Duas marinaravilhas, minha cara, duas filhas, minha cara bela e vai seguindo o rumo, e minha cara bela, e vai seguindo o rumo, e vida bela, e camará. Pra valer, morena, morena, camará. Vou ficar com você, vou viver com você, camará. Com Jesus vou morrer. Zeca, meu pai comprou VW mais novo. Zeca, meu pai mandou beijo, abraço, saudos. Zeca, meu pai comprou W mais novo. Zeca, meu pai, mandou beijo, abraço, gostoso. Para Beto, para Dina, chega a bênção de Claudina. Anda minha mãe Mufina, que saudade das meninas. Duas marinaravilhas, minha cara, duas filhas, minha cara bela. Vai seguindo rumo, e minha cara bela, e vai seguindo rumo, e vida bela, e camará, vida bela, e camará, Margarida, e me criou pra valer, morena, morena, camará, vou ficar com você, vou viver com você, camará, com Jesus. Zeca, meu pai comprou um Volkswagen Blue. Zeca, meu pai comprou um carrinho todo azul. Uau! É, mas também. meu pai comprou. Volkswagen Blue.